It's not just in fulfillment of my constitutional duty, but with great pride and respect for his many years of public service that I am today announcing my intention to nominate United States Circuit Judge Anthony Kennedy to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
It was November 1987 when President Ronald Reagan nominated Justice Anthony M. Kennedy to fill the seat vacated by Justice Lewis Powell.
He is known as a gentleman. He's popular with colleagues of all political persuasions. And I've noted he seems to be popular with many senators of varying political persuasions as well.
This week, on Wednesday, the last day of the term, Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. Kennedy, who is 81, will serve until the end of July. In an interview with C-SPAN back in 2009, Kennedy described the challenges of the job.
All the cases are hard. The only reason we take them, as some of my colleagues may tell you, is that other courts are in disagreement most of the time. And that means that other judges and other actors in the legal system have come to differing conclusions. Every case is that way.
For many years, Kennedy was the deciding force in those disagreements. Following the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor in 2005, Kennedy was often seen as the sole swing vote on the bench. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today, what's next for the highest court in the land in the absence of Justice Kennedy? Whether a new swing vote will emerge is unclear, as President Trump vowed on Wednesday to return to his initial short list of conservative justices to fill the post. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised a quick vote on the nominee by fall. Eric Posner is a law professor at the University of Chicago School of Law.
Justice Kennedy, in several cases, moved the court in the direction of protection of sexual minorities. And in Obergefell versus Hodges, he was the deciding vote where the court recognized a right to same-sex marriage.
And what about the preservation of Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think the Roe v. Wade case, which was called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, is probably his next most significant legacy after same-sex marriage. President Reagan appointed three justices, and I think most people thought that those justices would overturn Roe versus Wade, or at least conservatives hoped that they would. But in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, two of them, Justices O'Connor and Kennedy, voted to preserve the right to abortion, which had been recognized in Roe versus Wade. That said, Justice Kennedy in several other cases voted in favor of laws that restricted abortion somewhat, most famously a case involving what are called partial birth abortions, or sometimes called partial birth abortions. So his legacy is somewhat more mixed for abortion rights.
How did his ideology evolve over time? I mean, we just said he became sort of the swing vote, but did his own ideology evolve from where it was expected that he would take the court much further to the right than he actually did?
So his ideology evolved a little bit, but not as much as many people say. When he was nominated by President Reagan, I think most people understood that he was conservative. People didn't think he was as conservative as, for example, Robert Bork, who Reagan had nominated earlier and who had not been confirmed. But people thought that Kennedy would be pretty conservative. Within his first year or so, he was a relatively conservative justice. But quickly after that, he started voting occasionally in cases where he sided with the more liberal justices. But that happened relatively quickly, and I think his ideological stance on the court has remained relatively constant over the last, say, about 20 years.
Professor, you've also done research into something called the loyalty effect. Tell us what that is and how you think that might impact the president's next nominee.
Well, it turns out if you go back and look at how Supreme Court justices have voted throughout history, they tend to be quite supportive of the president who appoints them. So ideological drift does occur. It's actually quite common. But at least in the first few years, justices tend to support the government, you know, the government which is led by the president that appointed them. So while there are a lot of surprises, that seems to be a relative constant.
Now, there is a lot of concern, particularly among Democrats and non-conservatives, that the president has a list of nominees that are very ultra-conservative in many instances. Can you tell us a little bit about that list, who may be potentially the most concerning to folks?
You know, I'd prefer not to speculate about the ideological positions of the judges and other people on that list. I mean, you know, it's a little bit hard to tell. Obviously, Trump, like presidents before him, prefer to nominate people who they think will advance their political and ideological goals. That's been a pattern for a very long time. I do think that liberals should be concerned. It's pretty clear that President Trump will want to appoint somebody on the right, and definitely somebody farther to the right than Justice Kennedy was.
I'm speaking with Eric Posner of the University of Chicago School of Law about the legacy of Justice Kennedy. There is concern about specific issues that this court could take up again, at least among those who do not support the president. Some of those are, we've already mentioned, Roe versus Wade. There's also concern about other civil rights, including affirmative action. You said liberals should be concerned. How concerned and how realistic is it that we could see things like affirmative action targeted as well?
I think it's very likely, but somewhat hard to predict. I mean, when President Reagan appointed Kennedy and Scalia, many people thought that Roe versus Wade was going to be overturned. It wasn't. It's quite possible that President Trump will appoint somebody who he thinks is conservative and may really be conservative ideologically, but hesitates about overturning established precedents. On the other hand, I think it's equally likely that President Trump will appoint somebody who will go after a lot of these precedents. And I think at the top of the list would be Roe versus Wade. I think it's perfectly possible, even likely, that whoever Trump appoints will cast a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. I think on affirmative action, it's quite likely that whoever Trump appoints will cast a vote to either narrow or even overturn previous cases that have held that it's permissible for state universities and other government entities to practice affirmative action.
And also there have been lots of criticisms about how the Supreme Court, particularly with the recent rulings that we've seen up until this week, that the Supreme Court is increasingly becoming a tool of the presidency rather than a check on the presidency.
Yeah, although, you know, it's, I think, a little more complicated than that, because after all, the Supreme Court almost struck down President Obama's signature legislative achievement, which was the Affordable Care Act. Now, if it had, we would call that a check on the presidency. But I think, you know, liberals would have been very upset about that. I do think that, you know, the court's relationship with the presidency over history has been very complicated. And if you go back more than a couple decades, it has tended to be, you know, not much of a check on executive action, more of a check on state legislatures and in the last few decades on legislation enacted by Congress. But for example, when the president engages in military actions and other types of unilateral actions, maybe the court has not always been a tremendous check. That changed a little bit during the Bush administration when the court expressed some skepticism about the war on terror-related actions. But it may just be returning to the status quo.
We know that retired Justice John Paul Stevens once said, and I'm quoting here, that the political aspects of a federal judge's career should end when his or her nomination is confirmed. Do you think the court is more political now, given the divisiveness of the United States and everything that we've been seeing?
Oh, well, in some ways it's more political, but I think one needs to recognize the continuity. It's usually been the case throughout history that presidents have appointed ideologically compatible justices who have ruled in ways that are generally consistent with the president's ideology. And of course, there have been some important exceptions, but that's been the basic pattern, and it's been true for a very long time. What is true and what seems to be new is that the justices are divided along partisan and ideological lines in a way that is a lot more rigid and obvious than in the past. The Democratic appointees all lean left. The Republican appointees all lean right. There's very little overlap between them except in relatively non-controversial cases. And this makes the court, I think, look more political in many ways than it has in the past. That might, in the long run, damage the court's standing in the public, but it's hard to predict.
Eric Posner is a law professor at the University of Chicago School of Law. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Hi, this is Julia from Clayton, California. I do think that Judge Kennedy's position should definitely be filled immediately, with hopefully someone young, educated, empathetic, super sharp, and someone that knows the law inside and out.
Hi, my name is Eric. I'm calling from Brooklyn, and I think the Democrats shouldn't give an inch on this. I think they should do everything in their power to make sure that Trump doesn't get to pick the next Supreme Court justice. I'm 26 years old, and Republicans have won the popular vote once in my lifetime. And despite that fact, they have a stranglehold on the court. I think that makes no sense.
Hi, this is Joel from Queens. My guess is that President Trump is going to replace Justice Kennedy with one of the more moderate candidates on his published list.
This is Eli Savage from Portland, Oregon. Of course, it's frustrating. It also leads to questions of ethics. If the midterms lead to swing in the political makeup of the Senate and the House, do we do exactly what the Republicans did that was so reprehensible when they refused to nominate or even consider an Obama appointment? I mean, how do we take the high road when the conservatives are so craven and so without moral compass or conviction that they have no shame in their hypocrisy?
This is Mary from Queens, New York. The Democrats should not allow Justice Kennedy's seat to be filled until a Democratic president is in office, just like the Republicans did.
Dennis, Foxborough, Massachusetts. My answer to when the seat should be filled? Follow McConnell's rule. After the election.
And we want to hear more from you about your opinion on Justice Kennedy's retirement. Call and leave us a message with your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Over the past few months, much of the media coverage on immigration has focused on what happens to migrants after they get to the United States. But why are they coming?
Honduras has one of the highest femicide rates in the world.
This is Guatemala City's largest market, and business owners here are forced to pay extortion to gang members or face violent reprisals.
El Salvador, a country that has major problems with gangs and homicides. It's also one of the most dangerous places in the world for women.
There's no work here. Even if people study, they don't find jobs. It's a disaster. There's no work.
According to the most recent numbers released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, nearly 50% of migrants who cross and are apprehended at the border are from Central America, specifically El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. To help us understand the motivating factors to migration, we're joined by Adriana Beltran. Adriana is the Director of Citizen Security at the Washington Office on Latin America.
First, I would just like to say that, you know, if you look at overall figures, migration to the U.S. southern border has gone down, even though, you know, if you compare it to the numbers that you saw in the 90s, early 2000s, what you have seen in recent years has been an increase of asylum seekers arriving at the border. And as you mentioned, a large percentage of those are from the countries of the Northern Triangle, so Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala.
And the specific conditions, you mentioned many of them are asylum seekers. They are seeking asylum from what?
These are, you know, families, children, and women that are fleeing very dangerous situations. Many of them come from marginalized communities in their own countries, many communities that are now under the control of street gangs, or regions of the country that are under the control of criminal networks.
So isn't the president right to a certain extent to say we should stop migration from these countries? Does it not open the potential for some of those gang members to come across?
It's not gang members that are coming across. It's families that are in desperate need of protection. What I would emphasize is that you have situations where their own state authorities have not been able to address the situation. So if you look at, you know, rates of impunity for homicides alone, they're extremely high. In many of these communities, people fear the police as much as they fear the criminals. You have very weak institutions because of the lack of institution building following the conflicts in that part of the world.
Let's talk about some of those conflicts, because I don't think we can have a conversation about those conflicts without talking about the United States' involvement in Central America and Latin American politics, right?
Right. You know, both in Guatemala and in El Salvador that had internal armed conflicts, you know, the U.S. supported the counterinsurgency strategies in these countries. In the case of Honduras, they used Honduras as a way of, you know, fighting the left in Nicaragua. So in many ways, you know, the U.S. funded the militaries and the dictatorships that were committing these egregious human rights violations.
I'm speaking with Adriana Beltran about the root causes of migration to the United States from Central America. Adriana, let's talk a little bit about specifically each of these countries. The political situation today in Honduras, for example, where does that country stand?
Right. So Honduras had elections in November of last year. They were highly questioned elections, massive discontent, partly because the president ran for re-election despite a constitutional limit on the presidential term. There were many, many irregularities, delays throughout the process that led to diminished credibility of the electoral process and the institutions, and that ignited a wave of protests across the country. The state responded to those protests in a very aggressive way. You had security forces, mainly in this case, in the case of Honduras, the military police that used excessive use of force, including lethal force. You had cases where they used actual bullets to disperse the protesters.
And what are we seeing in Guatemala and El Salvador, briefly?
In the case of Guatemala, I would say that out of the three, it was the country that had been making the most progress in addressing this endemic corruption. And this has been greatly due to the presence of a UN-led commission that has really, working with the Attorney General's office, has unearthed and shed a light on this endemic corruption. But it has also, you know, just touched at the heart of the corruption. And so what you see now is this very strong backlash and campaign that has been carried out by the executive, by members of the legislature and their allies, to try to just halt this anti-corruption effort and get rid of the commission. In the case of El Salvador, I would say, you know, it is of the three a country that has faced extremely high levels of violence. In 2015, the homicide rate there reached a level that was even much higher than the level of violence that you saw during the war. A lot of that increase had to do with the unraveling of a gang truce that had occurred in previous years. And the response of the government since then has been a very aggressive, heavy-handed crackdown against whoever they perceive to be an alleged gang member. That has led to a number of, you know, confrontations between security forces and who they presume to be gang members in many of these marginalized communities. And what you're seeing is more and more an increasing number of abuses and even extrajudicial executions.
I want to also ask you about diplomatic relations between the United States and these countries. Outside of zero tolerance, what is the United States doing, or what should they be doing, to increase diplomacy and to maybe help, you know, mitigate some of this activity?
At the end of 2015, under the Obama administration, there was a significant increase of U.S. assistance to the region, particularly to these three countries. And significant aid has continued to address these factors that are causing irregular migration. You know, they look at issues of economic development, issues of corruption and weak governance, and the issue of security. I think there are, you know, a number of positive initiatives that the U.S. is supporting, including, you know, the Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, CICIG, that I mentioned. There's a similar body that the U.S. is supporting in Honduras. And I think those, you know, efforts that are showing results, we should continue to support, particularly when it comes to corruption and impunity.
Adriana Beltran is the Director of Citizen Security at the Washington Office on Latin America. Adriana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Over the weekend, residents in and around East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, protested the police shooting and killing of the unarmed teenager Antoine Rose II. But on Wednesday, Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zapala Jr. announced criminal charges against Officer Michael Rossfeld. Here to fill us in with the latest details is Megan Guza, criminal justice reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Megan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, Allegheny County DA Stephen Zapala announced criminal charges against the officer involved in this case. Tell us about those charges.
Right now it's one overarching charge of criminal homicide, which in Pennsylvania, that's the base charge. It can encompass anything from voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, and first, second, or third degree murder. The district attorney has said that he thinks he has the evidence for third degree murder, but he wants the option to prosecute murder in the first degree.
And when he thinks he has the evidence, does he mean beyond the video that we've seen, or...?
Beyond the video, there were about a half dozen witness statements, a lot of them corroborating what was seen in the video, and just the officer's statements on his own as well.
What are the reactions that you're hearing from people in different communities that you're covering, where Antoine Rose lived and went to school, about this latest development?
It's a range of emotions. It's base level. You've got relief. A colleague of mine went out to the housing complex where Antoine lived and talked to some neighbors, and she broke the news that charges had been filed to some people there, and the reactions were just, one woman broke down in tears, said, "Oh my God, my prayers have been answered. Thank you, Jesus." Others who knew him say, you know, he can be at peace now. There's also a lot of cautious optimism because I think there was, a lot of people were doubtful that charges would be filed.
And are they, I mean, I think there's also a lot of skepticism, no, about whether or not these charges will ultimately end in a conviction. Often with these cases, that's not the case.
Right. What a lot of people are kind of feeling is, you know, this was the first hurdle. Again, this was the first step we needed to get past. Just having charges filed is, I don't want to say cause for celebration for people who wanted to see this, but again, there's a sense of cautious optimism, and now it moves on to, you know, pushing and hoping for a conviction.
And let's talk a little bit about the police departments in this community. How are the municipalities in Allegheny County laid out?
In Allegheny County, you have the city of Pittsburgh, which has its own police department. And then you have, it's more than 130, I believe, municipalities all across the county. And at least 118 of them have their own police departments. So you have all of these small boroughs, townships, municipalities, and many of them, again, hire their own police force. And some of these police forces are fewer than 10 officers. The East Pittsburgh Police Department had 8 when this happened.
And what's the relationship like between the Allegheny County Police Department and the smaller police forces?
It depends on the department. The district attorney noted yesterday, you know, we have 118 police departments. Some of them are run very well. Others we have to keep an eye on all the time. The way it works is there's also an Allegheny County Police Department, and anytime there's a violent crime, a non-fatal shooting, or a homicide, they will come in and take over the investigation for municipal police.
And is that what's happening here?
Yeah. Anytime there's an officer-involved shooting, Allegheny County Police generally run the investigation, and that is what happened here.
And are you hearing, where do we think this is going? What are some of the next steps that you're looking out for in this case specifically?
The first one is that the protests have not slowed down. I think there was a little bit of expectation among county, municipal, city officials that this might kind of put people at ease. They might let up a little bit. But there were, just last night, two protests outside of the officer's house. The next step is just watching what happens. There is a preliminary hearing scheduled for next Friday. I suspect that will probably be continued because, this is a high-profile case. His attorney is going to want more time. And in Pennsylvania, you've got the preliminary hearings, and that's where a judge decides if there's enough evidence to move forward to trial. Right now, that is scheduled for Friday. But like I said, it's a wait-and-see game to see if that actually happens.
Megan Guza is the criminal justice reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Megan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we go now to West Virginia, where two branches of the state's government are simultaneously embroiled in scandal.
Earlier this morning, a federal indictment was unsealed, charging Justice Alan H. Loffrey II with 22 counts, including numerous fraud, false statements, and a witness tampering offense. A federal grand jury has charged a justice on the state's highest court with numerous and serious federal crimes. This is a solemn day for West Virginia and all West Virginians.
Corruption charges announced last week there against state Supreme Court Justice Alan Loffrey, and now lawmakers are on a path to impeachment and other justices could follow. Meanwhile, the state's Commerce Department is under fire for its mishandling of a flood recovery program. Jake Jarvis is going to help us sort it all out. He's a staff writer at the State Journal. Jake, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start out in the state Supreme Court. Why is Justice Alan Loffrey at risk of impeachment?
Well, it really started months ago, last fall, when there was some reporting that came out from a local TV station about lavish spending at the court. And we're talking millions of dollars had been invested into renovating the space. And that raised a lot of concerns and questions about some of the spending. For example, in Justice Loffrey's office, there was a $32,000 couch with $1,700 throw pillows. And so that raised a lot of concerns about, using a public office for private gain. So that launched a federal investigation, an investigation by a Judicial Investigations Commission here, legislative audits, and over the last couple of months, that information has been trickling out, and now we're in the process of possible impeachment.
And give us a sense of who Justice Loffrey is. What was his reputation like before now?
Yeah, well, he's a Republican in the state. He's been around for a while. He's been on the court since 2013. He was the Chief Justice last year. He's been since stepped down from that position. But what's interesting, though, is Justice Loffrey wrote a book on corruption. It was something like "Don't pay for an election. I won't buy another vote." And in one of the audits that came out, it came out that he used a state vehicle to improperly go to a book signing for this book about corruption. And so there's a little bit of irony with that.
I was going to say we can use the he literally wrote the book on this.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the other judges that might be implicated in all this. Mm-hmm.
Well, the other justices haven't been implicated as much, and of course, none of them have faced any federal indictment, but they have been implicated in some smaller legislative audits. And there's another justice, Justice Menas Ketchum, who's been mentioned. He's paid back several thousand dollars to the state for his use of state property. But it's not clear if any of the other justices will face such severe consequences like Justice Loffrey. The way it's worded, any of the justices could face that impeachment. And the lawmakers have signaled that they want to look at all five justices on the court to really suss out if any other people are responsible for wrongdoing.
Now, as we mentioned in the introduction here, there is turmoil in another part of West Virginia's government. Tell us about what's happening with flood recovery programs.
Right. Well, if you remember, 2 years ago, West Virginia had a really devastating flood. Two dozen people died. Lots of homes in really low-income areas were destroyed or damaged beyond repair. And so because of that, millions of dollars have flowed in. But one program in particular called RISE, it's a $150 million program funded through HUD, and there's been lots of questions of why it hasn't done more work until now. And so recently, a legislative audit came out that said that the agency overseeing it, the Commerce Department, illegally entered into several different contracts, totaling millions of dollars. And beyond that, a lot of people have questioned, why haven't these flood survivors Why haven't more of them gotten their homes yet? Only, I think, 20 or so is the most recent count of homes that have been rebuilt. Only a fraction of that total money has been spent. And as this has come out, there's really kind of been a clearing of house at the Commerce Department. The cabinet secretary is gone. At least four other people that we know of have been either fired or resigned because of this controversy surrounding the program.
And so you mentioned only a small percentage of West Virginians who had been waiting for flood relief have actually gotten it. What is the reaction that West Virginians and broadly are having to both this justice and this flood recovery program situation?
Well, they're definitely frustrated. Flood survivors have been raising concerns about the program last year. You know, some of them have said, we were told we'd get help next week or next month, and that just never happened because the money wasn't available to be spent until February of this year. So there's part of a communication problem. And now we see more lawmakers turning to Governor Justice to say, you know, why has this happened? Why are there so many concerns with this? Why are there so many problems with this? And actually now we're seeing more calls for Governor Justice to resign. The governor, he lives 2 hours away from Charleston, and so he's not here all the time. And some people feel like if he were here, if he had been in the Capitol all the time, he would have seen the problems with this and could have prevented it from getting to this point.
So the governor is actually coming under fire, it seems. Could we see other changes in West Virginia leadership after all this?
It's hard to know for sure, but calls for his resignation aren't entirely new. This is just his style of governance. He's a little hands off, but he says that he can still get the job done from wherever he is.
And what about the teachers' strike? Just briefly, has that had any impact on this either?
Mm-hmm. Well, teachers are definitely still fired up. They're in the process of trying to fix their health care, and there's still rallies going on. And we're seeing teachers try to apply pressure. They applied pressure in the primary, and they're looking for a couple of wins here in November.
We'll be paying close attention. Jake Jarvis, staff writer at the State Journal, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're already well into the 2018 summer movie season, and for Hollywood, that tends to mean big-budget escapism, superheroes, animated flicks, and maybe a romantic comedy. But this weekend, viewers will have the options to go somewhere that's actually been dominating our real-life headlines, the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's your chance to get even for your family. Who's gonna help us start a war?
With who?
Everyone.
Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro there in Sicario, Day of the Soldado. It's a sequel to the first Sicario, released in 2015. Both films center around the drug war at the southern border and the role of the United States government in that conflict. Certainly timely, but also somewhere we've been already with Latino characters in Hollywood. So do the Sicario films subvert these stereotypes? We have two guests here to weigh in. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Francis Negron Montaner is a filmmaker and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
So Rafer, you've seen the new Sicario. What did you think?
Well, this is as you said, this is a sequel. And the first one was sort of introducing us to these two characters, Josh Brolin, who is a kind of shadowy CIA dirty dealer type. And he's got this partner named Alejandro. We heard that clip of them talking about how they're going to start a war. What they want to do is basically disrupt the Mexican cartels by kidnapping the daughter of one of the kingpins and blaming a rival. And they're hoping that this will lead to a big shootout and sort of, you know, upset, upend, perhaps destroy the Mexican drug cartels. What happens, as I think we all could tell, the plan to kidnap this daughter does not go quite as planned. Things go awry. Alejandro and this girl, Isabella, they get stuck behind the Mexican border. And now to get across, all other options have been taken from them through various, elaborate ruses. Now they have to get across. And so what they do is they try to blend in with these poor Mexican immigrants who are trying to get across the border like everyone, with coyotes, paying money, getting on buses and hoping to make it across the border.
And let's talk a little bit about the worlds that are colliding here, right? Because we're in a moment right now where news is happening. We here at The Takeaway have been reporting extensively on what we're seeing at the southern border. How much, and Francis, I'll ask you first, and Rafer, I'll come back to you on your thoughts about this, but how much do we think what's happening in real life, is art imitating life? or does it have the potential to in this situation, Francis?
I think it's completely linked, actually. I mean, we can't really separate the media and public discourse that we use as frameworks from quote-unquote reality. In fact, there's actually no reality outside of the frameworks that we use to understand it. And I would say that in this case, the fact that this set of narratives and tropes and stereotypes have been around for over 100 years and pervade all our genres, not only cinema, movies that you go to see in the theater, but also television and even our news. I would say that the biggest reproducers of these ideas right now every single day is the evening news, which shares a lot in representation with movies. So in this regard, I would say you can't really separate the two. The frameworks that we use to construct and imagine what is reality are those provided by our narratives, by television, by cinema, by reporting, by what we read and consume.
So I want to broaden out a little bit, because when I think about Latino representation in media, when I think about it in films, there's so much emphasis on this idea of drug cartels and kingpins and
yes.
queenpins. And,
yes.
you know, I mean, I just feel like when I was thinking about today, I said, when was the last film that focused on Latino characters that didn't have anything to do with drug cartels or king and queen pins? Like, I'm thinking back to Stand and Deliver. I mean, is that
right,
Selena?
Right.
Like, how far back do we need to go to find a film that has to do with Latinos that is not about the drug world?
It's tough. There are not that many out there, and it's puzzling to me, because you know, Latinos are one of the most active and frequent movie going groups out there. I think they see more movies per year than any other ethnic group, and yet I think they're pretty underserved at the box office. You know, one of the only films I can think of, and I can't give it a wholehearted recommendation, but was A Better Life with Demian Bashir, and that was a pretty good immigration story about a guy who was a gardener. He was Mexican. He was here in the country and living this kind of hand-to-mouth and very tenuous existence. Any little slip-up clearly is going to cause him a lot of problems. He has a son who's here. You see this story and their existence from both sides. I thought the film was pretty clear-headed about what was going on. But, you know, it's tough to see.
Few and far between.
Tough to see a film with a Latino character that's really front and center.
Francis, do you think Hollywood is the place to look for these types of films? Or is it in independent film? Is it in documentary film where these stories are more likely to be told?
I mean, I see this as a multi-front issue, right? So on the one hand, those people that are in the industry and viewers that want to see different stories should be pressuring the industry to change, because the industry does change to some extent. Should we be expecting a widely definitive or widely satisfying account? Maybe not. And that's probably true for all subjects. On the other hand, I can also think about a number of independent films or films that come from independent producers or producers that have had a long independent life. For instance, you mentioned Selena earlier. And one of the things about Selena that's interesting is that one has one of the few border crossing scenes that actually not about drugs, which is when going south and not about sex or not about other kinds of subjects when Selena goes to Monterrey to promote her music. That's a border crossing that's not about any of that. And I also want to think about a film like Las Martas by an independent producer called Cristina Ibarra, which was a POV. It was on public television, and it was about a tradition in El Paso, Texas, of young women that dress up as Martha Washington in a kind of ball every year. So that's a border story about how cultures come together and what kind of dance there is in that space. That has nothing to do with it. So I think there are examples of alternatives, and I think independent films are going to be doing different work than Hollywood films. But I think we need all of the fronts to change and shift and have more people access the independent work and the perspectives that are there, and have Hollywood do a better job with their stories about the border and immigration.
And I think you also look at Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame. This was a Broadway musical that no one thought was really going to have the impact that it's since had, with diverse casting. Do either of you see that success being able to be replicated in Hollywood?
I think so far, it seems to me that women have made probably greater strides. I think African Americans have probably made greater strides in terms of getting themselves sort of really centrally in the spotlight in a movie, on the poster. I have not seen that happening to any great extent with Latinos. And, you know, that might be the next wave. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm just going to say that apart from power in Hollywood, obviously inside of Hollywood and who's making decisions, which is pivotal, there's also the issue of who's watching. And there's one of the strengths and sometimes maybe on leverage strengths of pushing change to go a little faster. Because as demographics continue to shift, and we already know that children are the future is already here, and it's a majority future. So empowering more the audience to have their feelings known and to help and participate in shaping what comes out of Hollywood and other venues, I think is another point of interest that I've devoted a bit of time to investigate. Like, how is it that we can empower audiences to be more demanding to what we consume?
Oh, we're curious to see what people think about the new Sicario film. Thank you both for being with us. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Francis Negro Muntaner is a filmmaker and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.